Hello and welcome to Bookness, a podcast about artist books brought to you by the Bodleian Libraries Centre for the Study of the Book. I'm Alice Evans, Assistant Book Conservator.
And I'm Jo Maddox, Assistant Curator of Rare Books. And over the coming podcast series, we're going to be delving into one of our favourite, possibly less well-known collections here at the Bodleian. We'll look at four books in detail, talk to their creators, and ask the questions that interest us most about their materiality and the intentions of the artist.
So Jo, you're responsible for acquiring and cataloguing a lot of these artist books. But what is an artist book?
Thanks, Alice. That's a really tricky question. I suppose, like any type of creative practice, artist books get harder to define the more closely you look at them. So the Library of Congress has one of the broadest definitions that I've found, which is that artist books are books that are produced by artists and intended as visual art objects. So they might be unique items or multiples, they might be published or unpublished works, but they're made by an artist and they're visual art. But if you listen to the series, you'll find that not all of the books we cover are intended as visual art. And you don't have to look very much further into the collection to find artist books that aren't made by artists, and some that arguably aren't even books.
Thanks, Jo. That's quite confusing still, but a good start.
You're welcome, Alice. So then let me ask you, what is it that you do at the library, and how do you encounter artist books in your work?
So I'm a book conservator, and I work in the conservation and collection care team here at the Bodleian, and our role is to care for and preserve the library's collections, which might be through monitoring and maintaining a good environment in all our library spaces, checking for any pests, and of course the practical treatment and repair of objects.
So what kind of objects do you normally work on?
My team work on objects from around the world, which could be an early printed book on handmade paper, an illuminated parchment manuscript, a Chinese hand scroll, a collection of early photographs, or it could be a complicated mixed media object, like some of the artist books we will be discussing in this series. And these have certainly caused our team to scratch our heads quite a bit when we've been thinking about how we should best look after them, particularly those that are made of unusual materials that might be susceptible to change, or are particularly fragile, or within themselves are deliberately self-destructive, and we have to weigh up the options for their treatment with both access and preservation in mind.
So now you've heard a bit about us, let's get on with the podcast.
First up, we grabbed Chris Fletcher, Keeper of Special Collections, who gave us a whistle-stop tour of some of his favourite artist books and an idea of what it's like to be the holder of the Special Collections purse strings. Welcome, Chris. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
We thought we'd just start by asking you to introduce yourself and what your role here at the Bodleian is.
Okay, so my title is Keeper of Special Collections, which means I'm responsible for staff of about 80 people. And they are all committed to building our collections, looking after the collections, describing the collections, and then doing things with those collections. So either helping readers look at them in reading rooms or supporting projects, exhibitions, so on and so forth.
So thinking about artists' books and the collections at the Bodleian, how do you go about building a collection of artist books like the one here?
That's a very good question and a difficult one to answer. The collections at the Bodleian are encyclopedic, kaleidoscopic, never-ending. In a sense, it's always a question where, how do we build? Do we just keep in the same traditions, enhancing what we've got, or do we strike out in new areas, or perhaps a bit of both? And certainly in the case of artist books, I feel, and contemporary artist books, I feel it's a way in which we can really be free to go after things that reflect a whole interesting diversity of views, geographical locations, techniques, and approaches. It's a way we can really spice up and mix up our collections. It sounds rather old-fashioned, but you're never going to acquire anything unless you have curatorial passion. People who are looking out, keeping their ears to the ground, who identify interesting things, have a hunch, take a punt sometimes. I think for me as well, we do quite a bit of teaching in the Bodleian from our collections, particularly taught graduate students. And I've noticed over the last few years, and of course they respond to the world's most expensive book or a beautiful illuminated manuscript, an unpublished letter by a significant writer. But students' responses to artists' books has been really arresting to me. It's something about their beauty, the technical facility and ingenuity with which they're produced, and some of the issues that they speak to, really galvanize students who, like the rest of us, bathe in a digital world and so much text, so many publications come to us digitally, that I think suddenly confronting the analog form pulls them up sharp.
Would you say when you're collecting, is there a deliberate attempt to push the boundaries of what people might expect of the Bodleian and what the book is in general?
I mean, I think one of the collections that I helped to acquire early on in my career here was The Archive of Agrippa, which was a book published in 1992, programmed to self-destruct. And that plays with the notions of the book, the typographical format mimics the Gutenberg Bible, which of course we have a copy. And the book was really designed to mess with the minds of people like me and conservators, and raises questions about longevity, about value. And it's a gloriously ironic acquisition in a way, because this was a book that was never meant to last. But here it is, enshrined in the Bodleian, carefully looked after by conservators, seriously studied in our reading room. And I guess that got me thinking about books that question their identity as books and question our assumptions about what a book is. So yes, in short, I am very keen to acquire things that are provocative in that way. An edition of Fahrenheit 451 that can't be read unless you expose it to flame, a book that will never be read in the Bodleian.
Bodley's Librarian Glossary Check.
Hello again. Thanks there to Richard Ovenden, Bodley's Librarian, who has jumped in to glossary check Chris's reference there to the Bodley Oath. The Bodleian Oath is said by all new members of staff and readers who swear, among other things, not to kindle a flame or fire in the library. One reason why this particular book will never be read. Back to Chris.
A book called Endless Sleep by Stephen Emerson that is actually made of three layers, or pages, if you like, of wasp's nest. Very, very difficult to handle. And of course, witty, because what do wasps make? They make paper. Notoriously, I guess, this keeps coming up, is a book by Ben Denzer called 20 Slices, which is 20 slices of encapsulated Kraft cheese, of which I think only 10 copies were made. Again, playfully, quite, what is a leaf? You know, is a slice of Kraft cheese the leaf of a book if it's bound up and has a title?
So it really seems that you are particularly drawn towards books that use unusual materials and processes. Could you speak a bit more about that?
Yeah, very much material and technique that speaks to the meaning of the work or enhances it or can even subvert it in some respect. So one book we acquired recently was a short story by Jane Bowles, not completed, called Andrew. And it deals with outcasts and ephemeral characters. And Nancy Lober, the maker of this book, gives them a life in a very beautiful coloured book. And the technique she uses is one of woodcut reduction. So in creating the images of the characters, she prints from a block, And then she cuts the block down to apply another colour, prints from that, cuts it down again, so on and so forth. And I love the fact that in creating these colourful characters, she is actually turning the source of their origin, the wood block, into something that ultimately is destroyed. Mm. And that resonates with the story itself, the impermanence of these characters, their vulnerability. Of course, that book also comes in a beautiful box, which includes two marionette puppets with embroidered tunics that Nancy made herself, and a set of sparklers that relate to the story, but of course, something else that can never fulfil its promise in the body will never be allowed to light them.
Do you think there are any materials that you wouldn't consider acquiring? Is there anything that would be pushing the limits too far?
We wouldn't take a book that ticked with a bomb inside it.
True.
No, I think we like to push boundaries, but I think you still, these books, they still have to have an intellectual integrity. They have to have some sort of aesthetic value, and they have to be technically clever. They have to be intelligent and meaningful. And I guess anybody could do anything that was provocative and just say, well, this is a book. But it has to have some combination of those things. And I think it also has to speak somehow of books or bookishness. We're a library, after all.
Yes. And then I guess it's a collaborative conversation between the departments about how to preserve it and how to look after it.
Yeah, exactly. But in a sense, the Denzer cheese book has so far lasted pretty well. It's been well looked after. We have legal deposit books that come in as a matter of course, and anyone who's bought a cheaply produced paperback and discovered it falling apart in their hands as they tried to read it will understand that any book can be vulnerable.
Yeah, definitely. And we were wondering, do you have a particular favourite in the Artist Book Collection?
It depends. I mean, it changes. Everyone is a favourite. I loved quite a modest book by Gaylord Chanelec called A Little Book of Birds, which is wood engravings of birds, but he has deliberately not cut the pages of the book, so you're forced to sort of peer into them as though you're looking at a bird hiding in a hedgerow. And again, I think I was talking to him about that, and it's gently provocative. Does a library understand that as a concept, or does it cut the pages?
There's only one other question on our list, and you've already answered it a little bit, but if you'd like to say anything else about how the collections are used in teaching.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, the collections are there for anyone to call up to the reading room. That's a very good form of research. It's what we do, but it's quite passive. So I love to see things in teaching. And so, for example, every year, Andrew Honey and me, a fellow conservator, show items from our collections. And we don't ask them to prepare for that. We want them to react to what they see on the table. And we always include artist books as part of that. And it's wonderful to see their responses. One, again, book I'm very fond of is by somebody called Hammy. And the title is It Is Bitter to Leave Your Home, a true story depicted in typographical images. And it's a book about the Fukushima nuclear disaster and the implications of that. It's very, very beautifully printed using typographical devices to create recognizable images. And it's obviously a very, very profound, very heavy subject, which is contrasted by physical format of the book itself, which is actually printed on kitchen paper. And what I love to do with that book is, and it looks like a solid, heavy book, is actually just pass it to one of the students and see their reaction when they feel how incredibly light it is. That's the sort of thing that gives me a kick. Mm. And a number of these students go on to do DPhils. Some of them are interested about pursuing a career in curation. Some of them even go into the book trade and then end up selling us books at a premium price. But there you go. That's sometimes the cost of success in getting people interested in bibliographical matters.
We also caught up with Professors Emma Smith and Adam Smythe here at the Western Library about what artist books mean to them and how they use them in their own thinking about books and their materiality.
Emma teaches English here at Oxford University, specialising in Shakespeare, and is one of the curators of the Sensational Books exhibition, which is on at the Western Library in Oxford until the 4th of December 2022, and which features many wonderful examples of artist books.
Adam also teaches English here at Oxford, particularly the early modern period, and is an editor of Inscription, the Journal of Material Text, a publication which explores mark-making and materiality in all different ways.
We started by asking them both how they use artist books in their work and teaching.
Well, I've come really late to artist books, but I'm a complete evangelist for them right now. Not super knowledgeable, but starting to think, how they can often be beautiful objects. They can ask really interesting questions about more ordinary books. They engage with book practices and book handling in some really fabulous ways. And I came to that really because of this exhibition that we've just been doing, Sensational Books, where lots of the ways in which books appeal to the different senses are really played with and amplified in artists' books. So I am definitely thinking that these are objects, beautiful objects, that open up really interesting teaching questions.
I do use them sometimes, particularly in graduate teaching, MST teaching, when we're thinking about the affordances of a book, the way a book has a particular logic or an architecture, how we might move through it, what a book can and can't do. I think artist books sometimes, I mean, they're useful for lots of reasons, but one of the reasons they're very useful is for drawing out the potential of books to do interesting things, to work in surprising ways.
Yeah, they sometimes make explicit things that are otherwise...
Exactly.
But then you can go back to, as I say, normal books.
Exactly. There
is such a normal thing as a normal book, and maybe that makes the normal books seem a bit less normal.
Fancy that. I think that divide between regular books and artist books, that's a permeable wall, isn't it? We go back. And that very good definition of artist book by Joanna Drucker. Artist books are books that are self-conscious about the form of the book. They're kind of reflecting on themselves always. How do I work? What does it mean to have pages in sequence or to be in a codex form? They're really good artist books exposing those questions, I think.
One of the things that you talk about in your book, Portable Magic, Emma, is you say that Ben Denzer's work combines form and context so completely that they are identical. Could you talk a bit more about form and content and how they contribute to what we think of as a book?
Yeah. I think one of the ways that artists' books reflect on bookness and are kind of meta books, they're books about books in some way, they're about the book form, that's one of their purposes. And I think, so Ben Denzer's book Made of Cheese has no writing on it apart from on the spine and the cover where it has the title, which is American Cheese. So there's no content apart from form. I mean, it's a book made of cheese. And one argument would be it's about cheese. That would be its kind of subject. I mean, really, it's about being a book, isn't it? And whether how far you could put, you could push that. And then just got, you know, loads of different books of, you know, dollar bills and books of ketchup sachets and books of sweeteners and all kinds of stuff. And it's almost it's a kind of challenge, kind of to see, will you, how far will you go with me on this? Is this one still a book? Is this one still a book? Is this one still a book? So I think form and content are the same in Denza's cheese book, but I think it's not quite true to say form and content are cheese. I think probably form and content are book.
Emma, you recently said that a book that is not handled is not really a book. I wonder if either of you have any thoughts on this in relation to artist books and the tension that they might create between access and preservation in the library.
I think that tension between access and preservation is so fascinating, and that is a, you know, really brilliant thing that some of those concept artist books, the Griffith book, you know, really, really engage with. I think I would be on the side of access, partly because constitutionally I am a bit overwhelmed by preservation. I feel as if somehow in our urge to keep everything, we are just completely overburdening the people of the future. And I know that's a very sort of wrong thing in a way to say in a library which has been dedicated to preserving that heritage in such wonderful ways. But I would be about access. You know, books are not reverential objects. They're not relics.
You're going to have to go.
So, I mean, I would be about access, rather than preservation. And I am interested in why, I'm actually really genuinely interested in why book destruction has become the red button kind of image of illiberalism and, you know, fascism and all those. It's so interestingly located in books as objects in ways which I think are sort of fascinating and not necessarily inevitable. That's a sort of cultural choice.
Yeah, I'm definitely on the side of access, partly because books are things that are made to be read, and that's important. Partly because one of the amazing things about books is that they do endure through time, and that the books around us now will be here in centuries' time, and they'll have marks of that time and those moments of use, and that's good. But also, specifically in terms of artist books, I mean, a crucial moment in that genre, I think, was the 60s in America, wasn't it, when people like Ed Ruscha were making those books like All the Streets on Sunset Boulevard, that wonderful fold-out book. And they were deliberately printed in high print runs, very cheaply. They're physically unremarkable in some ways. If you read it now in the British Library, it's very precious, but it's also very battered and crumbling. And so in origin, as a genre, they were very committed to being democratic and to being multiple and to being cheap. Now, there are obviously lots of complications with that as they become collected and they get institutionalised and canalised. These things become much more expensive and become collectible. But at their heart, they're a way of getting information and ideas that might be in an exclusive gallery in cheap books and scattering it out there in the world. So I do think it's important that people have access to them.
Yeah, I think it's been very interesting making this podcast and talking to a lot of the artists who've made these books, because actually I think they're very much on that side as well. And Ben Denza even said the word co-authorship about the reader and changes that occur to his works once they become part of a collection like this, where they are being used for teaching, when they're being called up and read by a reader or a researcher. And they seem very interested and on board with the changes that occur. Some of these books that we're talking about are quite alive. Mm. Ben Denza did describe the cheese book as alive and is ever changing.
That's Americans for you. That's not alive, that cheese.
True.
Let's hope not. We hope the conversations in this episode have given you a taster of the artist book collection here at the Bodleian, and that you'll join us for the next 4 episodes of Bookness, where we will be looking more closely at 4 objects from the collection.
Thanks again to Chris Fletcher, Adam Smythe and Emma Smith for chatting to us in this episode, and the team at the Centre for the Study of the Book for helping us put together Bookness. And back to Emma for a final thought about books and art and their changing place here at the library and in Oxford.
I love thinking about that moment when the Bodleian and the museums in Oxford divvied up what was their sphere of expertise, and, you know, books became a category, and fossils and skulls became a category, and art became a category. And it's kind of really, you can see why that happened. It's really important sort of intellectual, epistemological moment and stuff, but it feels really good to sort of get away from that now in a way, and sort of push at the book as a more inclusive kind of space.